While not everyone accepts the thesis, it has some merit. North Carolina sociologist John Shelton Reed has ventured a related explanation. To him, Southerners are a quasi-ethnic group. Indeed, Reed wrote the Southerners' entry in the Harvard Encyclopedia of American Ethnic Groups. Thus, in his view, the South remains as much a sociological phenomenon as a geographical one, with a strong, separate, historically shaped identity. According to Reed's measurements, anti-South sentiment in the United States is greatest among New Englanders, which is fitting. Persisting animosities between the two regions have sparked secession movements on both sides. Keeping in mind that the South, rather than the Eastern or New England states, controlled the youthful federal government between 1800 and 1824, the first actual grousing about possible secession had a nasal Yankee twang. Even as colonies, the New England areas had periodically been grouped together. In John Winthrop's New England Confederation of 1643, and again in the short-lived Dominion of New England ordered by London in 1686. After Virginian Thomas Jefferson succeeded John Adams of Massachusetts as president in 1801, separatism became a semi-public conversation in Hartford and Boston. By 1804, regional politicians led by Massachusetts Senator Timothy Pickering talked of a northern confederacy that would include the New England states, New York, and New Jersey. War with Britain in 1812, crippling to New England commerce, rekindled enough sectional tension that Jefferson wrote to Adams in 1813, the two ex-presidents were now friends and correspondents, that rivalry between Massachusetts and Virginia had the makings of a civil war a la Vendée. Virginia was agricultural. Massachusetts depended on its exposed maritime economy. In late 1814, New Englanders gathered at the Hartford Convention to mull separatism and other anti-Southern measures. Inept and embarrassing timing, because General Andrew Jackson was about to ignite war-related public euphoria by defeating a British invasion at the Battle of New Orleans. As late as 1820, President James Monroe worried that Senator Rufus King of New York, one of the few Federalists still in office, hoped to lead a confederation of that state and New England. The Missouri Compromise of 1820, however, allowed Maine to enter the Union as a free state while Missouri joined as a slave state, maintaining the critical North-South balance in the U.S. Senate and the Electoral College, and refocusing the political centrality of slavery. Some early 19th century observers, idealizing the rapid rise of the trans-Appalachian New West, pictured it transcending and chastening the old Atlantic Seacoast division so visible since 1787. However, that turned out to be a cultural mirage, just as the more observant founding fathers had feared. Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, Charles Pinckney, and others all foresaw that fights over new states would unfold around electoral balance and the geography of slavery. Between 1787 and 1848, westward movement from the Old South filled in population as far as Missouri, Arkansas, and Texas, with a southward leg into Florida, while Yankees, whose great emigration awaited canals and railroads, reached Michigan, Iowa, and Wisconsin. The contest between the North and South to populate their western hinterlands engendered political jockeying over new state admissions. This persisted until the Mexican War ended, and California's admission as a free state in 1850 tipped the balance. No more plausible territories for slave states remained. By then, Southern leaders, seeing the predominantly Northern handwriting on the westbound railroad tickets, understood their imperative to look farther afield, adding Cuba, say, or three or four states in Northern Mexico. Less plausibly, they could open up the territories of Kansas and Nebraska, under the Act of 1854, to popular sovereignty, workable only if enough pro-slavery men could move in. Ambitions south of the border lingered through the late 1850s. The two U.S. senators from Mississippi, Jefferson Davis and Albert Gallatin Brown, openly pointed to Cuba and the Mexican states of Yucatan, San Luis Potosí, and Tamaulipas. When these alternatives stalled or unraveled in the late 1850s, secession or confrontation grew more likely. This Cook's tour of North-South rivalry should underscore why the political, religious, and cultural mobilizations preparatory to open combat in 1861 were steeped in such acrimony. Long-standing frustrations, hopes, and disdains were coming to a head. Among them, as we will see, were specific religious concerns, including divergent interpretations of what the Bible said about slavery. These helped to precipitate the Civil War, then infused its conduct on both sides with righteousness, a quality reheated after 1865 across a South subjected to military-backed Reconstruction. With little exaggeration, these vitriolic clashes of scriptural interpretation and denominational fratricide could be called a hidden civil war.